Our next guest says women face a torrent of abuse, hatred, and the ugliest kinds of threats on the internet. University of Maryland law professor Danielle Citrin, an expert on privacy and cyberbullying, calls targeted abuse a civil rights issue, and she argues for new laws to help tame internet trolls and stalkers. Some who agree want to see an end to online anonymity. Critics say new policies and laws would only threaten the internet's hard-won rights to First Amendment protections. We'll learn more about these issues from Danielle Citrin today on Midday, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Sorry, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Among the thorniest issues the Supreme Court will decide this year or in this present session is the case of a Pennsylvania man who posted a series of graphically violent rap lyrics on Facebook about his desire to kill his estranged wife, shoot up a kindergarten class, and attack an FBI agent. The man's wife was not amused. Neither was a jury that convicted him of violating a federal law that makes it a crime to threaten another person. The defendant argued that he was just joking and didn't really mean it. The government argued that it doesn't matter whether he meant it or not. The fact is that his wife felt threatened enough to make the charge stick. Internet free speech advocates argue that no matter how nasty the post was, the woman was never in danger, and a conviction would weaken the internet as a bastion of free speech and expression. And there lies the crux of a question that our next guest debates in a provocative new book called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Danielle Citrin, a law professor at the University of Maryland, says women in particular face a barrage of harassment, cyberstalking, hateful posts, threats, revenge porn, and other uncivilized behavior on the web. In extreme cases, it can wreck their emotional lives and their livelihoods. While men may be harassed online, Danielle Citrin says it's usually because of positions they've taken, opinions that they've registered. But the vitriol directed at women is largely targeted at their gender. One of the more common forms of harassment is revenge porn, nude or intimate pictures taken by ex-husbands or lovers in better days, and posted online for revenge and humiliation. Too often, our guest says, society at large writes off these transgressions as Wild West behavior in an online world that has no bearing on reality. But Danielle Citrin argues that the internet is a large part of people's lives and careers now and should be governed by society's rules. She wants federal laws amended to make online service providers and social media sites liable for the most hateful content posted by their members. But First Amendment advocates say this protection is critical in keeping the web open to all political, social, and artistic ideas, even if it means that jerks get to be jerks. Danielle Citrin supports state-level laws such as Maryland's new penalties for posting revenge porn and urges a push for new civil rights legislation to protect women's interests online. What do you think? Do women need special protection from online predators? Or should they realize that the internet is a tough neighborhood and stop complaining about it? We'll talk about that in this hour of the show and learn more about it from Danielle Citrin, professor at the University of Maryland School of Law and a prominent advocate for women's online rights. She's also an expert on privacy. Last time she was on our show was to discuss this very topic, cyberbullying. Now she's back with a book, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, which is available from Harvard University Press. Nice to have you back on the show, Professor Citrin.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Nice to see you, Danielle.
You too.
Do you mind if we just start with that Pennsylvania case? I wanted to ask you about that right off the bat. This man claims he was only kidding, but a jury convicted him, as I said, of a federal crime, making a threat, and a judge sentenced him to 4 years. So can you fill us in about this story a little bit and how it came about and what its ramifications could be?
Right. So the case involves Facebook postings that were graphic, directed at his ex-wife. They were really specific and unmistakably a threat. So I'm going to take your body, dump it in a river, and were clearly aimed at the ex-wife. Some were on the post. Some were posted on his sister-in-law's Facebook page, and others were on his own. After the wife sees it, she gets word from her sister that this has been posted. She gets a protective order. It's in the context of a very contentious, nasty divorce in which the husband has alleged to be very abusive physically. So she gets a protective order against Alonis. And after she's gotten this protective order, he keeps at it. And he keeps threatening her. And it's only after there's been a protective order that he starts describing what he's doing as part of rap music, that it's art, right? That he's just kidding. But it has fundamentally changed the way she lives her life, right? She moves. She's terrified. It takes away her liberty. I mean, that's what threats do. And we don't protect threats. That is, the Supreme Court has made clear that there are certain categories of speech, including threats, that we don't protect because they're so low value and they produce so much harm. So the question before the Supreme Court is whether, in assessing a true threat, whether a threat falls outside the protection of the First Amendment, whether we're going to require that there be proof that the defendant subjectively intended to make a threat, put someone in fear of their life, or if it's enough that, objectively speaking, the reasonable either speaker or listener would understand it as a threat, right? Because we say, look, we don't protect true threats because they invade the liberty of the object of the threat.
Is this case interesting because it involves the internet and Facebook? I mean, if that man wrote letters to his wife, if he wrote notes and stuck them on her car under the car windshield or something, couldn't it potentially have had the same effect on her?
Well, that's right. I mean, they were specific. They were targeted. She was a named, you know, individual letters. It's not like some puffery that relates to all women. This was targeted at the ex-wife, very specific, calling her out, leaving no room for interpretation about what he meant, right? It wasn't, I will do this, or someone should hurt you. It was, I'm going to do this to you. I'm going to dump you in the body. I'm going to strangle you and throw you in the river. It was very clear.
Targeted is the word you use. Targeted abuse.
Right. Targeted abuse.
A targeted threat.
Right.
Okay. And this is, I said this this year, there isn't much time left in this year. The Supreme Court this session could deal with this issue.
Right. They heard the argument before the Supreme Court. This was 2 weeks ago on Monday. Mm-hmm. And there were spirited arguments on both sides. The government arguing that we don't need to have a subjective intent standard, that the whole point of the true threats doctrine is to protect people from threats that invade their liberty, that deprive them of the ability to live their lives as they wish without the fear, perpetual fear of harm sort of around their shoulder. And on the other hand, the ACLU, and the best sort of written brief was by the defense counsel, amici brief was the ACLU's brief. And the set of arguments I think that were some of the most persuasive was that, look, we need more than just an objective standard. That is, we need subjectivity required because we need some breathing room for speech online, that speech could be forwarded onto other people. And before we say that speech is prescribable as a threat, we've got to be sure that the defendant knows when the defendant is saying it, that they're engaging in unprotected activity, and that the intent is the gateway to ways in which we can prevent chilling of legitimate expression. So at least that's some of the most sort of persuasive arguments that we heard before the court.
What do you say to people who argue, well, the internet is a free speech zone, it can be a rough neighborhood, you got to let stuff bounce off of you. If you don't like it, move on to someplace else. There are protections in place. You can block people on Facebook. You don't have to participate in any of this at all, really. You don't have to be on Twitter.
Right.
What do you say to folks who take that point of view?
Right. No, and that's what people say to journalists like Amanda Hess when she faced threats on her Twitter feed.
I remember that, yeah.
Right? And the response was, get off Twitter. It's no big deal. You cannot say that to a journalist, right? You make a living spreading
your work.
Do your work.
Right.
You use these network tools. They're indispensable to making a living. And to say to someone, just get off, employers don't stop Googling your name, right? So you can shut off your computer, but employers, friends, and clients Google your name. And when they find threats, lies, privacy invasions, including your nude photos, they don't hire you. You don't get a job. And so you can't ignore what's included in it, whether it's on your Twitter feed or it's on Facebook or a third party site.
Let's say I agree with the statement that no one should be bullied off of the internet. The internet should be for everyone. You should feel free to go on there. Then we get to the question of who gets to decide how to protect you on the internet. How far do we go? Government, for instance, First Amendment issue. How far does government go in protecting that zone for you?
Right. And so I'm really careful in my book to make sure that the legal agenda that I articulate, both for the enforcement of existing law and for the adoption of new reforms at the state and federal level, are within the First Amendment doctrine. That is, I only recommend that we can prescribe categories of speech that we've already said either have no protection, like defamation of private individuals, crime facilitating speech or true threats, or speech that enjoys far less rigorous protection. And that's like the public disclosure of private communications about purely private matters, like a nude photo. No one has a legitimate interest in knowing about anyone's, you know, seeing a sex video that they didn't want to release to the public, or their nude photos. Even celebrities have a right to privacy in their nude photos, right?
What about hate speech?
Hate speech is fully protected speech, and I argue in the book that we should absolutely permit it to be spoken because there's opportunities for counter speech, hateful speech. It's nasty, it's ugly, and we protect it because there are opportunities to respond to it, right? All women are stupid. I'm going to feel emboldened, frankly, as a blogger at Forbes to write, no, all women are not stupid, and I'm not feeling under siege, under assault, right? And we all do when it comes to hate speech, but at least we can have a conversation. We can meet hateful speech about groups with speech, counter speech, and say, no, that's not right. Holocaust denial, right? We can say, no, the Holocaust happened. Here's some historical facts. But when someone is under assault with directed threats, defamation, like accusations that someone has a sexually transmitted infection, their home address being posted next to the suggestion they're interested in sex, what is the counter speech to that, right? You can't say, I shouldn't be raped. No, I don't have herpes, right? There really isn't a meaningful opportunity for dialogue. I'm not saying I'm Pollyannish about hate speech, right, that we're going to have this robust conversation, but there are opportunities for it in a way that when we talk about harassment and stalking of a particular targeted individual, there really can't be counter conversation.
So you've been very careful in your book to say, well, this is law. Actually, we have laws in place already that this would fall under. And this is civil standard, so to speak, societal standard that isn't really regulated by law. It's regulated by the standards of the society, right?
That's right. So there's only so much law can do. Law is a blunt instrument, right? So we have to rely on much more than law. I mean, yes, it would be fantastic if we enforced laws already on the books about stalking, harassment, and threats. It would go a long way to deterring a lot of this really job-inhibiting abuse online. But also, there's so much abuse that just is not covered by law, and that's where social processes fit in, right? That intermediaries, online platforms, it's their platform.
Mm-hmm.
They can decide that, hey, we're not the kind of community that wants to tolerate this. You know, think about Xbox, Microsoft's Xbox. They have pretty strong community rules. And they say, look, we want our users to feel safe. And so we don't accept threats. We don't accept speech that makes you feel bad about yourself. And that's their right to do it. Online service providers, I think, have a crucial role to make a difference, to teach us how to be better digital citizens. They can, of course, do nothing. That's their absolute right. They're not government. They can do whatever they want, right? But they could make a big difference.
We'll take a break here. Danielle Citrin is our guest on Midday, a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, an expert in privacy, and a prominent advocate for women's rights online. Her new book is Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, and she argues that women in particular are more frequently targeted by cyberstalkers and more likely than men to be subject to vitriolic attacks, threats, and revenge porn. More on this when we get back. A short break. Phone calls are welcome. 410-662-8780. Our Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, published by Harvard University Press, Danielle Citron's book. She teaches at the University of Maryland School of Law. And we had you on the show, I'm guessing, 3 years ago to first talk about cyberbullying, which you were getting into then. And I wonder, it seems like we're hearing more about this topic, about harassment online, about targeted online abuse of individuals, because women in particular have been writing about it, posting about it, and then getting abused because they do it. But I wonder, what sense do you have, or what data do you have on the scale of this problem? I mean, how, and my follow-up question is that going to be, do we even recognize that this is a problem? Or are people getting used to this in cyberspace and saying, well, it's just part of life on the internet?
Right. Okay. So two questions. Yeah. The first is,
the scale.
What's the scale of this? So in 2006, the Bureau of Justice Statistics did a study that found that approximately 850,000 people experience stalking via network technologies in a year. Right. And that number has surely grown because the study was conducted in 2006. And Pew came out with a study, I want to say 2 months ago, that found that approximately 20% of all women within this sort of 20 to 30 age group experience some form of sexual harassment online and stalking, which has the definition of like repeated targeted speech out a particular individual that causes the person to fear for their lives. So it's a very specific and narrow definition. So that's a pretty big number, right?
It is.
And there's some studies suggest that it's growing.
It's a survey. These are studies. Is the Bureau of Justice Statistics. Where would that information have come from? From self-reporting?
No, the Department of Justice has, so the BJS study is a number of researchers working for the Bureau of Justice Statistics. I think they surveyed like 1,500 people. And I don't think they were self-selecting. So it was like amongst an audience of individuals, and they found, so that's how they got.
They extrapolated from a survey.
That's right. So it's survey-based.
I'm just wondering about data. Do people even report this to authority? Where would you report this?
Right. No, it's such a great question because it gets to the fact that we often lack really meaningful statistics. That is, I think we have a much bigger problem on our hands because there have been studies that suggest that people don't report online abuse because they think and know that law enforcement won't take it seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, that goes to your second question, right?
About whether we accept it on some level. I'm not saying it's acceptable. I don't like it either. I actually hate it. But you get online or you see comments on, I don't know, Twitter or talk threads, newspaper websites, magazine websites, all kinds of websites. And you see crude, ugly comments. The trolls drop in there and blow up some conversation with some ugly statement of some kind. Or even a threat of some kind, or ad hominem attack, a personal attack on somebody. And you say, well, that's, you know, we're getting used to that because that's out there.
Right. And there's a line that we cross that we should never have to get used to, which is targeted attacks that are threatening, that terrify people so they leave their homes, that put them at increased risk of actual physical attack and stalking. Defamation. We're not getting used to that, right?
Yeah.
So lies that someone is a prostitute, that they have herpes and a low LSAT score can prevent them from getting a job. As a society, we've said, look, that's not okay. We don't think that when you hijack someone's careers and professional lives, that it's acceptable. We don't say that, right? We also don't say that certain kinds of privacy invasions, like the posting of someone's nude photo or their social security number, that'll never be acceptable. So I think there's a big difference between, you know, nasty, offensive speech that can disrupt conversations that we do accept, right? We don't have to, but many moderators do, or their scale of their user community is so large that they just live with it. But there's other kinds of abuse that we say is covered by the law, because there's so negligible value in it, right? It doesn't contribute to public conversation of any stripe, right? It's just the assault on individuals to ensure they can't get a job, they can't get a date, right? Clients or friends.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the, I mean,
or to embarrass them.
Absolutely.
In public,
humiliate
this is public.
And expose.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, that's fundamentally, you're taking away someone's ability to work, to be have some parts of their lives that are private, that are just theirs, and turn it into a mode of humiliation and surveillance.
You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Daniel Citron, C-I-T-R-O-N, is our guest. He's a professor of law at the University of Maryland and publisher of a book now called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. A question for you from Twitter. One of our listeners, Laurie, says, how is this different from sexual harassment not being covered by the First Amendment?
Right. And so the Supreme Court has found that using Title VII, bringing it to bear against sexual harassment in the workplace, is not protected by the First Amendment, because what we're punishing isn't hateful speech. We're punishing the targeting of someone because of their gender, race, religion, some form of protected characteristic, and the interference with their tangible economic opportunities. And so for this very same reason, we can bring those same civil rights laws to bear against bigoted harassment, because it's designed to interfere with people's tangible life opportunities to work, to speak, right, to be a part of a conversation that helps them get jobs. We know that over 80% of employers use Google as a CV, as your resume. And then in over 80% of the cases, there's a negative result. And this falls so hard on harassment victims. And it's—
Excuse me, let's go over that again.
Sure.
So employers use Google for 80% of their background checks on people?
That's right. So in 2009, okay, Microsoft did a study that found that over 80% of employers admit to using Google as an employment search tool. And that makes absolute sense.
They Google
sense.
Your name? Okay.
Of course, right?
Okay, but then what was the second part of that?
Ready? So in 80% of the cases, there's a negative result. So that the employer says they chose not to interview. They chose not to hire someone due to postings online. And I think it's—
Which may or may not have been true.
Which may or may not have been true. And in fact, one of the biggest category of their explanation of why there was a negative outcome, whether or not to hire, not to interview, was unsuitable photographs and unsuitable lifestyle.
Okay.
Right? So clearly, so often—
So some of that could have been self-inflicted on the applicant's part, right?
Oh, no, that's absolutely true, right? But what I think, and in talking to so many employers, the response to me was, we don't believe so often when it comes to nude photos that the person put it up themselves, but it's so much safer and cheaper to hire someone who doesn't come with that kind of baggage, because then clients won't question, why did you hire the person,
mm-hmm,
right? It's not that they think that individuals put up the lies, the privacy invasions, right, themselves, or did anything to provoke it. It's that employers, frankly, are taking the smart path of least resistance, which is to hire amongst so many really worthy people now. You know how hard it is to get a job, no matter what your field. That when it comes to two equally bright, you know, people, we're going to choose the person who doesn't have to struggle with harassment, and then whose online searches can't be used against the employer as well.
Right. That's a tough one, because once something gets out there on the internet, either words or images, it's very hard to get control of it again.
That's right.
Even though you think you had control at the start. I noted here on a recent show that we did on data mining and data collection by big companies, the European Union had enacted a right to be forgotten law that requires web search operators to eliminate specific links to individuals at their request, largely aimed at old legal actions, convictions, court records that people want erased. We don't have such a law in this country. Has anybody patrolled that realm yet to see if we should be doing something there?
Right. So, I mean, so many of these companies have that we, you know, Google has a European, has to comply with this right to be forgotten.
Right.
So Facebook, so many other companies, their biggest user bases, frankly, are outside the United States. So European privacy laws are actually being brought to bear against these companies, in which we are also just a small part of their user base. But in terms of bringing this right to be forgotten to the United States, I think there's some certain value to thinking about the right to be forgotten, especially when it comes to speech that has no legitimate connection to public cultural conversation, right?
Right?
Especially think about nude photos, right? Revenge porn. Given our commitment to free speech, the argument that the right to be forgotten should be in the hands of search engines, right, making these decisions about what falls in and out of what's legitimate, I think it's troubling for Google to be the decider. I'd much rather that a court would be the decider. So I think if we were to have this conversation in the United States, we'd be mindful that it would only apply to speech we could prescribe, like threats, defamation, mm-hmm, of private individuals.
Right, going back to that.
Going back to the sort of set, mm-hmm, categories. And even then, it would need to be a court and not a search engine making these crucial decisions. And I think that's exactly right.
Speaking of revenge porn, of course, Maryland passed a law this past General Assembly session, now one of 13 states that have statutes related to, I think it's 16 states now, have statutes related to revenge porn. The Maryland law makes revenge porn a misdemeanor with up to 2 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. Specifically, the law makes it a crime to post identifiable images or videos of a person engaged in sexually explicit activity to the internet without that person's consent. Do we know from research who is more often the target of this, men or women?
There's some sort of, it's not a new phenomenon. So I've been working on this issue of harassment since 2007. And so when I started my research and started talking to victims, there were sites like Private Voyeur, which is a revenge porn site, essentially, that had nude photos of people. So it's not like revenge porn in the last 18 months is this sort of new phenomenon and it came out of nowhere. No, unfortunately, it's been a part of sort of our online universe for quite some time, for at least 7 years, right? But in the last 18 months, lawmakers across the country have been paying attention. And so it went from having basically two states that had revenge porn statutes, New Jersey and Alaska. We've now added 14 more. And it's been, I think, an important move in the right direction to criminalize, you know, intentional invasions of privacy that are malicious and done knowing the person had an expectation of privacy.
What is the website isanyoneup.com?
Right. So that's a former revenge porn site.
It's no longer exists?
It's no longer exists. The website operator, Hunter Moore, sold it. And then now he's actually under indictment for conspiracy. He was engaged in a hacking ring to steal people's nude photos from their computers and then post them without their permission, along with their home addresses and sort of snapshots of their Facebook pages. But it was one of the first most prominent ones. And he was so well known for basically bragging to the press that he was untouchable. That because of the Communications Decency Act of 1996, that as a website operator, he enjoyed total immunity from liability.
He thought he was protected under the First Amendment?
And in many respects, not the First Amendment.
But under what?
But under this federal law that we were talking about during break that immunizes site operators from liability for the postings of others. A law passed in 1996 called the Decency Act, right? It was designed to sort of get rid of pornography on the internet, and much of that law was struck down as totally unconstitutional. But what remained was a provision that was designed to protect good Samaritans that were engaging in the blocking of offensive material. And I'm quoting the sort of subheading of the statute. And it said that site operators and ISPs wouldn't be held liable as speakers or publishers of other people's content. Right. And how that's been understood over time is very broad. It doesn't just protect sites from speaker and publisher liability, but also distributor liability. So then when sites get notice that there's revenge porn on their sites, they're totally immune from liability. They're even immune when they encourage users to post nude photos, knowing that they're not, you know, saying encourage people to post revenge porn and then post it without any repercussion. And, you know, frankly, Hunter Moore wasn't wrong. When he was bragging to the press shamelessly that he was immune from liability, he was quite right. He wasn't immune from breaking federal criminal law, right? But he couldn't be sued civilly because that law, the Decency Act, Section 230, has been really interpreted very broadly so that site operators are not immune from liability for the postings of their users, even if it's so clearly criminal and that they're informed that it's criminal.
Well, that begs the question for me that I've been dying to ask you since I knew you were going to be on the show. Newspaper websites, magazine websites, I mentioned that before, they all have talk threads, comment threads. And almost anything can appear on those comment threads, it seems to me. Some are filtered, some are edited, many are not. And I've heard it argued that better not to touch them at all, just to leave them as an open forum, because we, the people who run this website, a magazine, whatever it is, a newspaper, a website, we have no liability for, say, a slanderous or libelous content. We're just going to leave it alone. That if we get into the business of editing and touching it, so to speak, then we become more liable.
Right. So lower court decisions, and that's only the only courts have heard it. The Supreme Court has not heard a case involving Section 230.
Oh, no.
But lower court opinions have fairly uniformly found that if sites edit a little bit, they're not liable, right, for user-generated content. In fact, it's contrary to the very intention of the drafters of Section 230 was to encourage good Samaritans to monitor, block, tailor offensive material, even if they did it incompletely. So that's just, I think, a misinterpretation of Section 230. So
Section
they can
230,
edit.
The Communications Decency Act.
Right. And let's say the word decency one more time, right? This is like...
That was about getting porn out of public libraries, wasn't it?
That's right. No, that's exactly right. Yeah. And that part of... Most of the statute was struck down, the Decency Act. Can you imagine the internet without porn? Right? That was the effort... But it was an effort that failed. The Supreme Court, and really one of the most important opinions in ACLU versus Reno, found that, look, struck down most of the Decency Act because it said, look, we're not going to control the internet so that it's safe for children, right? It's not a TV set. It is a many splendored thing. And for the internet to thrive, we can insist that protected speech be removed, right? But the one sort of remaining part of that statute is Section 230 of the Decency Act.
Danielle Citrin is our guest. She's a law professor at the University of Maryland and a publisher, not a publisher, the author of a new book on hate speech, hate activity,
crimes.
Hate crimes in cyberspace, in online abuse. It's all about that. So if you want to join us here, if you have a question for Danielle Citrin, please give us a ring. This is a good time to call 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long distance number, 866-661-9309, and you can reach us by email, send a question by email or a comment to midday@wypr.org.
Waterman. The fall menu includes golden beet ravioli with goat cheese, brown butter, and pistachios. Full menu and reservations available at bemorebiroteca.com. Support also comes from Bowie & Jensen, a full-service business law firm representing clients ranging from individuals and small businesses to emerging companies and large corporations. Their construction...
Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Danielle Citrin from the University of Maryland School of Law. Her book, again, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, is published by Harvard University Press. We were talking about the Maryland revenge porn law. And I note here from my producer, Mike Himowitz, who said the first prosecution under the new law occurred in Frederick County in October. Well, at least he was charged. A man, a Brunswick, Maryland man, was charged under this new statute, the first person in Maryland. He was accused of posting sexually explicit videos of his ex-girlfriend to pornographic websites and in online accounts, including her address. He also encouraged other men to rape her, allegedly. That's according to the charging documents. This is exactly what you're talking about. That's why that law is in place. And, you know, when I first heard about that law, it was proposed by the state delegate, John Cardin. My first reaction might have been the reaction of other people saying, why is this an issue? Really, is this that important? I guess because I wasn't aware of this activity, it didn't really make the connection or wonder... I guess I wondered what the scale or the scope of the problem was.
I think that was a question I didn't answer when we were talking
before.
I'm not sure
you can yet. It sounds like you have some research, but not a great deal yet.
We do have a little bit. So the organization, the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, run by a revenge porn victim who's just been tremendous, Holly Jacobs. She's has her doctorate in industrial psychology. She started this organization because her nude photo, her home address, her work address were all over the internet. We're talking over 300 posts, some just as the new Brunswick man, the case that you just talked about, had the suggestion she was interested in sex. Some of the posts said that she was available for sex like a prostitute. Others lies that she slept with her students as a grad student. And she changed her name. She basically went underground for a series of years. And then finally, after she's at the sort of heart of my book, one of the three stories I tell, you know, Holly finally said, like, look, enough is enough. I want to go public. Too many times that I've gone to, in her case, she lived in Florida. She went to Florida law enforcement. And the response was, oh, you shared those photos with your boyfriend. They're his property. Give me a break, right? There's nothing you can do about it. When in fact, Florida law would have covered postings on harassing postings on third-party sites, right? And so she just had had enough. She started the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, and she recently put up a survey. And within that is to find out who's suffering or confronting revenge porn, and who are these people? You know, she has a doctorate in part in statistics. So within 3 months of her putting up the survey, there were over 1,500 respondents. And she found that over 90%, so you asked Dan before, you know, who is it? What's the scale? And then who is it? Is experiencing it? That over 90% of the respondents, so of course it's a limited study, it's self-selected, but nonetheless were women. So we do are increasingly beginning to learn about the problem, but you're right, because so often we've ignored it. We know we don't know enough, and it needs to be studied.
As a person who writes opinions, I found it interesting to note that men will be criticized, abused, harassed online for their opinions about things.
Yeah,
if they state
more
them
likely,
on
right.
social, more likely on social media.
Right.
Whereas women are abused for being women.
Right. No, that's true. And what's really interesting, though, is that when men experience harassment, it often lines up with the same way that women experience. So it's not just threats, but it's threats of sexual violence. So rape threats for women, threats of anal rape for men. And it's not just lies about them, but it's lies that they have sexually transmitted infections. So for women, it's often herpes. Men are accused of having AIDS. Or they're also accused of being child predators. So it's like sort of turning that narrative upside down. And it's not just any kind of privacy invasion, but nude photographs. So it's true that men, when they experience sort of targeted stalking and harassment, their employers receive emails with their nude photos. So it's definitely not just women. It's true that the majority of victims are women. But when men are targeted, the abuse is like a playbook. I swear it's repeat and rewind every time, right? That whenever I talk to victims or read stories, it's sexually threatening and sexually humiliating targeted abuse that's designed to make sure people can't get jobs and have great difficulty, you know, basically finding a date, as Holly once said to me.
Would you mind telling the story of the woman who was hounded on the internet for reporting out some comments she heard? This was a woman from Boulder, Colorado, who was at a conference, a business conference related to her work. And she overheard some men behind her make, a derogatory sexual remark of some kind.
Right.
Can you tell that story?
Yeah. So Audrey Richards is a well-known...
Audrey Richards?
Yeah, is a well-known technologist, developer, who and brander, sort of like she would brand software and technology, working in tech. And she was at a tech conference that frankly had notoriety for sexual harassment at conferences. But she was sitting behind two men who were joking about dongles. Like, it seemed sexualized what they were saying. And she didn't just say to them, you know, unfortunately, she didn't sort of resolve it with them. And I imagine she probably felt intimidated, but she tweeted about it. And she's tweeted also a picture of them. And so we can have a conversation about whether she should have done that, like the privacy exposure, right?
They made some derogatory sexual comment?
Comment about their dongles and who was going to fondle their dongles or something like that. Okay. And she felt uncomfortable.
But she tweeted it out?
She tweeted it out along with their picture. But what, so the response. Right. It's interesting. So we might say she's kind of engaging in some, even though it's in public, it's at a conference.
She's trying to shame
them
publicly?
But she was trying to shame them. So I'm not leaving her off the hook for the first instance. But what came back at her is unacceptable. Right. So she tweets about it. The conference, those running the conference, they took it seriously. They went and spoke to the guys. They said, look, this is not cool. But what then happened?
Excuse me. One of them lost his job.
Well,
right.
Because it seems like it was consistent with other complaints about this person. And so one of the two guys lost his job and then blogged about it. And then the cyber mob went after Adria Richards with such a venom. She received countless rape threats via email and via Twitter. Graphic, disgusting, frightening rape threats. Her employer, SendGrid, was overwhelmed with distributed denial of service attacks that shut down their website, right? So they went after both Audrey Richards and her employer. And the craziest thing is the cyber mob accomplished its goals because SendGrid fired Audrey Richards. So she was unprotected, right?
On what grounds did they fire her? She just caused too much trouble for the company by...
Precisely. I mean, it's almost like you said better, frankly, than what they said. But basically, she caused too much trouble, and we don't like that, and they fired her. So truly...
You know, part of my reaction to that story is, why isn't it enough just to criticize her for not having turned around at the conference and said, shh, you guys, stop, or something like that.
Right.
Okay, you can criticize her
for
tweeting out the guys. Okay, but why does it go to rape? Why is the answer to, is it because of anonymity? This is the next thing I want to ask you about.
Sure.
Do people feel free to say these things on the internet because they're anonymous?
Right. I mean, so anonymity brings out, I think, the best and the worst in us, right? Because we feel like unaccountable for our words, we're free to almost say things we would never say in person. And that could be the domestic violence abuse victim who speaks out in a chat room because she feels comfortable or he feels comfortable because there won't be repercussions, right? But at the same time, feeling anonymous lets us act on really destructive behavior because we won't be shamed and caught, right? There won't be the kind of consequences as if you did it face to face. So anonymity is a double-edged sword, right? It brings out so much wonderful speech. At the same time, it can fuel really destructive behavior because that seems consequence-free.
What do you do about that? I don't know how you legislate something like
right.
that. I know as on a policy level, you could say, well, going back to my experience, which is with newspapers, magazines, what people post online, you could say, attach your name, your real name, to this statement before we post it. We want you to stand behind what you have to say. I understand it's a free country, and you can be anonymous someplace else, but on our website, which is a newspaper, magazine, or whatever, we want your name attached to it. We want you to stand behind your words. Would that help?
Okay, so
that's sort of like civil order. Not. I'm not calling for legislation.
Right. Okay. So absolutely right. So two different questions. Law. Let's put that aside. We protect anonymity, especially when it comes to political, religious speech.
Right.
But what about the website? It's their site, just like in a diner. It's your diner. It's your place of business. You can make sets of decisions, and should you want to say we don't accept anonymity, of course they could. Do I think that we should get rid of anonymity and require registration? I think ultimately it's a wrong move. I think we lose too much and gain too little, right? I think anonymity should be a privilege that can be lost so that we permit anonymity as a default. In privacy, it's all about default rules, right? So that the default rule is, yes, anonymity. But if a site sees that someone's being destructive to community norms, then there can be costs. The cost could be you have to post in your name. The cost could be we're actually not going to show your comment, or we're going to really, it's all the way down the queue so people can barely see it. And that's so often what newspapers do, is they sort of downvote really destructive comments. And sometimes it's the user community downvoting comments, right? And sometimes given
we
the scale.
We could use more of that, I think. You talk about the good Samaritans out there who see comments that shouldn't be posted at all, and then they can influence who gets to the source that's posting it.
That's right. And that's facilitated by the site operator allows users, it almost with scale problems, it's great to harness your user community, right? You have your user community police community norms. So a game developer, League of Legends, has done exactly that. They saw it was really hard to scale enforcement of their community norms for, in particular, harassment and bullying. And they created incentives for their users to serve on what they called juries, that when there were cases or complaints of harassment and bullying, certain players served on juries. And what they found, League of Legends, was that their juries were making decisions right most of the time. And so now they let their user community make their decisions, so they have less of a scale problem with moderation because it's like free help.
Curious, do you happen to know what the gender breakdown is for that community?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know about League of Legends, but you know that half of gamers are women.
And women. So let's say they were 50%. It's one half saying, leave the other half alone here.
Let's
protect them.
And I would say that's probably those juries were mixed gender, right? So that it was male and female.
Right.
Basically saying, like, especially because they were identifiable and there were going to be, they got points or rewards for serving on juries. There were incentives, part of it. And they got it right, apparently, nearly most of the time.
But you are talking about some legislation, some changes to law here. And you think the Supreme Court ruling in this case could be pretty important, the one we talked about at the beginning, in terms of sending a message through the rest of the country?
It could be, right? I think actually if it comes down either way, right, it's not, the Supreme Court is not going to change its mind for 100 years or more that threats are outside the First Amendment, right?
Right.
We're not going to change our mind. We may require more proof to provide sort of more buffer with free speech, right, to prevent chilling and require subjective intent. Even in either case, I think the court is going to note that there is content that's threatening, that's unacceptable. It is liberty denying, right? It's terrifying. And it's often a precursor to violence, especially in domestic violence cases. And so it's not okay. It falls outside the protection of the First Amendment. So I think either way the court decides, it's not going to say true threats are enjoy the full protection of the First Amendment.
And so how would you approach this on the state level? Let's say in Maryland, right, that we've already addressed revenge porn, but beyond that.
Right. No, I think I actually see the states as really the laboratories for change here. I mean, stalking and harassment laws, they came from the states. California was the first in 1990, and within 3 years, all 50 states had stalking and harassment laws that need to be updated, many of them, to sort of keep peace with changing technology, but not to be bound by technology, right, so that they're not constantly being outmoded. I think the states should be the ones that respond to this harassment and abuse, and they can do better with their state civil rights laws. California has a civil rights law that would get at and provide penalties and let AGs bring lawsuits on behalf of individuals to seek civil penalties for bias-related harassment and stalking. And I think that's precisely what we need to do in Maryland.
Bias-related, meaning your gender,
right,
your race, right, being targeted. Hey, let me read a comment for you,
sure,
Danielle, from Alice, one of our listeners, by email. I think that our association with computers being a portal to something, quote, unreal, whether it is games, stories, movies, et cetera, is a factor in this issue. Many people seem to forget that on the other end of the wires is another live human being. And many of these people putting forth threats would never do or say these things in person. It gets to the anonymity,
exactly,
issue.
But that's precisely right. Like, we think
we
of
think
people
that
as images.
Some unreal, or that cyberspace is some unreal thing.
Place,
really,
right.
Now it's central to our lives and the work we do.
Right. Right. It's almost like it's a vision of the internet from 1995. Before we really had the way in which it's steeped in everything that we do. It isn't some other place. It's part of who we are,
mm-hmm,
now, right? Wherever you have your cell phone, you're online. So and employers are looking at it. So the idea that it's some other place out there, I think, is this naive, uninformed view of how we use, of course, network technologies. They're everywhere we are, right? And I think part of what she was saying, rightly so, is that the problem is people almost seem like images. You can cut them and they won't bleed. But of course, when you attack someone, it's a real person on the other side of the cell phone, and they really suffer.
Yeah, yeah. It's also as a measure of how civil our society is. You look at the internet and you want to think for a moment, well, that's not really a reflection of the real society we live in.
Yeah.
The one, you know, that's on city streets, that's in buses and cars and in our workplaces. But actually, well, why separate it? How can you distinguish it, really?
Right, you can't.
I mean, it is part of life today.
That's right. And so, but it is depressing.
It
right?
is depressing. I was going to say, it is a little depressing to think of that as a reflection of our society.
Right. I was just reading, I don't know if you saw this, a piece about what we behave like on when we board a plane and
yeah,
how we misbehave and we're rude, right? In the same way, right? We're rude and nasty and brutish online,
you mean,
right?
You mean
that's not just face-to-face.
When you go for a flight, you behave in a different way?
No, we're our worst selves, right? Because we're cranky, we're hungry.
Right, and we have expectations, right?
Serve me. People mm-hmm. act like such jerks, right? Mm-hmm. And they push their seat forward.
Someone was comparing that with how we behave on the internet?
No, I was just now. I was thinking of, you know, that you said...
You become a different person, you mean, because
right,
of this. I think to
right,
Alice's point,
that's right,
because you think this is an unreal world, that there aren't real people there.
Right, and there aren't social cues to stop you.
Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, the name of Danielle Keats Citrin's book from Harvard University Press. She's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. It's been a pleasure to have you back on the show. It's a really interesting topic, and you're right. This is a new frontier of civil rights, and we'll have to keep our eye on that as we move along. Thank you very much, Danielle.
Thank you so much.
Nice to have you
it's
with us.
It's been fun.
Yep. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. I want to thank Andy Bienstock for running the board for us today. Thank you, Andy, for directing our show. We'll be back again tomorrow. So have a great afternoon. Thanks for listening. Dan Roderick's here. See you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.